free love on the free love freeway. The love is free and the freeway's long. I got some hot love on the hot love highway. Ain't going home cause my baby's gone. She's not dead.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Soundtracking your free love on the free love freeway since 1982.
Long time later, see a cowboy crying. Says, hey buddy, what can I do? Says, I lived a good life, about 1,000 women. I said, well, why the tears? He says, cause none of them was you. No, he's looking at a photograph.
Of you?
No, of his girlfriend. The video would have shown that, yeah.
It sounds a bit gay.
It's not gay.
Welcome to Transition State.
I like to party fucking hard. I like my rock and roll the same. Don't give a fuck if I burn out. Don't give a fuck if I fade away. Back to the murder league with me. Before I'm forced to face the wrath of a well-refined public who lived vicariously through. Tortured out his contract for punching Macho Pablum. Back to the Motor League I go. What thought I drew a lucky hand turned out to be a live grenade. Oh my god, oh shit. Play acting anarchists and mommy's little skinheads. Death with a single fence, a winner struck a straight edge. Fuck off, who cares? I'd rather have my triptychs than listen to your bullshit. Fuck off, who cares? A bunch of stupid scenes, your shitty scenes, the strong men you build up to burn never ceases to amaze. And as I'm suffering of perfection, reminds me of my own race. Redress my own debt is the real. Mouth feet, eating hats, teeny balls. Amish phone books, drunken brawls. Swell and chicken conformists, fist in the air. Like father likes the rebels, put it on corn, M&M's and biscuits. We're here, a prayer. Take back your Amy Grandma's cruise, your forever politics. We'll dry my hair and stick me on a 10 speed. Back to the motor lead. Back to the motor lead. Life is just a popularity contest. It's just a ability to perform within a framework of obedience. Just as the champion courage or dead on best-selling shoes. A venture cap with silence and competing messages running up the jagged edges.
Stock personnel, front checkouts, front checkouts, stock personnel.
Fuck! Was most terrified when your parents left the house. He would creep up to the room, to the drawer, beside the bed. We would pull out the shining door. One side dink, the other side Jesus. Not hedonists, not atheists. Churchgoers, black parents. I wonder what lurks in neighbor's shorts. The most pristine are hiding everything. Is this a decaying society? And these are
Don't condemn your life. Run away with shame. Everyone chance. Cause natural disasters.
Put their chairs up. Let the glasses that you broke form a picture of our leader with a halo made of smoke. Let the golden oldies station crackle and come through with a final benediction. Say goodnight. Let her talk about the ball game and the weather show we care, like a sound we didn't notice until it stopped and left us there. With the traffic and our heartbeats beating in straight time, let our hatred and affection march in the same line before we say goodbye. Protect our secret handshake once more with feeling. Let the toast to absent members push through the ceiling before we say goodnight.
Weather used to be.
And I'll cater
Salt air. Now, if you excuse me, I have a concert to attend.
On December 5th, Mint Records will be hosting this year's ridiculously early Xmas party at the Astoria with performances by Rennie Wilson, Monomyth, Fake Tears, Energy Slime, Supermoon, Uptights, and a Faith Healer solo set. CITR Femme Concept DJs will be playing the hits all night long, and yes, there will be presents for the first 50 people. Visit mintrex.com for more details. Remember, it's this December 5th at the Astoria.
Tune in every other Sunday from 3 to 4 p.m. for Blood on the Sabbath with your host, Dan N., the real, authentic country.
All right. Welcome, radio fans. You're listening to Transition State on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or CITR.ca on the internet around the globe and into the ether shooting through the solar system, possibly into other galaxies. We just heard from The Weaker Thans, and before that was Propagandy. The Weaker Thans were two tracks from their album Reconstruction Site, one of the best Canadian albums of all time. We heard Psalm for the Elk's Lodge Last Call, and also Plea from a Cat Named Vertute. Before that, we heard from Propagandy, one of the best Canadian bands of all time. We heard Back to the Motor League and Natural Disasters. So we've got a bang, bang, bang show lined up for you this week, radio fans. I got a great interview with opioid addictions activist Chris Kull. You may know him from films he's done or his Inspired by Example project. That's coming up very soon. So if you want to learn a little bit about what goes in or what sort of causative factors go into opioid addiction and what we can do to kind of treat it and help people get out of it, then stay tuned for that. In fact, I think I'm going to play that right now. Let's just go straight to the interview. So this is me talking with Chris Kull. It happened about a week ago on CITR 101.9 FM. All right, so I'm sitting here with Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I personally know a little bit about you, but maybe some of my listeners out there maybe haven't heard of you, so would you mind just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yep. yeah, my name's Chris Kull. I'm 30 years old from a small town called Bowmanville, Ontario, and I am a person in recovery at the moment from a opioid dependency. I last year, I rode a bicycle across Canada and filmed a documentary about my own story and documented stories from one coast to the other, just to highlight how bad the problem has become. And but also part of and all that was me doing all the stuff I wanted to do that I couldn't do when I couldn't travel because of the opioid dependency. So hit golf balls off the mountaintops of British Columbia, jumped out of an airplane in Montreal, whitewater rafted in Northern Ontario, and just to show others and provide a sense of hope of what can be in life and that addiction is not the end of the road for you.
Okay, very interesting. And you filmed the whole thing?
Yeah. Filmed the whole documentary and just finished that now and submitted it to Sundance. And
Hey.
So, and I'm doing the ride again next summer, so it's second I get home, I got to get back to training and dieting, which I'm not looking forward to whatsoever.
Okay, there's so much interesting stuff that I want to talk about in that. So you biked across the country?
Yeah, Victoria, BC to St. John's, Newfoundland.
No way. How long did that take?
May 15th to August 27th.
Okay.
It's about 3.5 months, give or take.
By yourself?
Well, my camera crew, my...
Okay.
Yeah, but I was the only one on a bike doing my thing, so... Yeah, it was a lot of fun, though.
What was the best?
My favorite town, I think, in Canada was Canmore, Alberta. I love that place. It's so beautiful. And everybody's there super nice and active and fit and cares about the community. And they're just like elk running around and everywhere,
right,
which is
yeah.
pretty cool. But, yeah, got to see all the Rockies through and through. Got smoked by a car in the Rockies, but thankfully it wasn't bad enough to stop me from continuing.
Oh, man.
And, yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Wow. Yeah, okay. And Cameron, you'd be happy to just be on the other side of the Rockies, too.
Yeah. I get a lot of that about the prairies, but the prairies are a lot more difficult than you would imagine. Even though it's just flat and open fields, there's days where I'm giving it all I have in the prairies, and I can't get anywhere because the wind's in my face. And and it's dead straightaways for 30-40
yeah.
kilometers. So it's the mental game of giving it all you got, and you can't get past 15 kilometers an hour when on average I do 35. And then having the wind and riding through the rain and all that stuff. So I thought that was probably one of the hardest parts of the entire ride, to be honest.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, you also mentioned opioid dependency.
Yes, I was opioid dependent for 7-8 years.
Do you mind if we talk about that?
Not at all.
So how did that, first of all, what was that like?
It was a horrible experience. I lost everything that meant anything to me to it. Six figures in cash I spent on OxyContin in 2 years. I lost my house, lost my girlfriend at the time, and... there's a lot of you naturally become very manipulative and you lie a lot, you steal, you do what you got to do to live that double life, so to speak, in order to make sure you have your narcotic or your, well, in my case, OxyContin. So it was very, I don't know, it was very, in retrospect, now that I'm doing great, it was a very humbling experience and very, I don't know. Very educational. So
okay. I'll take that.
I don't know how else to put it?
I'm really curious how you kind of fell into opioid addiction.
It started out with my father had Huntington's disease,
okay.
and he was trying to take his own life on a fairly consistent basis, and it was just him and I living together and. He eventually succeeded, and I just wasn't emotionally nor maturely developed enough at the time to handle it productively. And I started out with Percocet to try to numb it out so I could continue on and just, like, not bring everyone down around me.
Yeah.
But that quickly escalated into 580 milligram OxyContins a day for 2 years. And that sent my life into a complete hell.
Okay. So... regular listeners of this show should know that this is a show dedicated to pharmaceutical awareness. So I know that you can't get Percocets or OxyContin without a prescription and then a pharmacist to fill it. So where did you...
People who had prescriptions were selling their prescriptions on the street, and that's how I managed to get mine. But it can still start, like... The addiction to opioids can start with everything from a legit... injury or like a legit prescription after a car accident or something to that effect. And that's why I think education is the key to, I mean, the opioid problem has been growing substantially over the next last maybe 10 years, maybe even longer than that. But I think education is the key to it all. And a great website, actually, for opioid dependency is orbok.ca, powered by Indivior, that, yeah, it gets for anybody who suspects that their loved one might have a problem, there's tests you can do on there. It has a resource locator for doctors or emotional help pertaining to it. And yeah, it gives you a better rundown on all the symptoms of withdrawal and what to look for in somebody.
Okay, great resource. Orbok.ca.
Orbok.ca.
O-R-B-E-O-K.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. Do you see anything as being, like you mentioned some hard times as like sort of catalyzing the fall into addiction? Do you see anything as being like a root cause?
That's difficult. Like, I mean, I think it started out with, I was just devastated when my dad passed away. I had nobody. Like, I just didn't know how to handle it. And I'm a bit of a believer in that a lot of like substance abuse can start from like either emotional pain or physical pain or some kind of pain that it originates from. And that's certainly where mine, in retrospect, started from. But I mean, it was a very long process to from like I'm 30 years old now, but I was 22 when I started. And so when I was going, even when I was on, because I was on methadone for 5 years.
Okay.
And like in that 5 years, I went 2 years without gas, where I was heating my water on the stove just to bathe myself, and had a curtain off my living room, use electric heaters, and had to steal my food. It was going up to 4 days without eating on over a dozen separate occasions, where I had to like go steal food just to survive. And it was and that was when I wasn't doing drugs. I was just blown so much money on drugs that I was just,
Wow. And was that all this in Vancouver?
No, it was in a small town called Bowmanville, Ontario.
Okay.
So
that where you're from?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
From,
Then what was it that, obviously you're a different person sitting with me now.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So it's like night and day.
How did you get out of that? I'm sure there are people out there who are in that same position now. How do you get from there to where you are now?
Well, I think it was more to the point where I had lost everything that meant anything to me. And that was kind of my bottom, where I knew I needed some kind of help. And so I wasn't too aware of what my resources were. And that's the great thing about the website, orbok.ca, that actually has a resource-based area where you can find that and find out what the actual different avenues are. But once I found, I went on methadone at the time, and what spawned my ride and my project and everything was the fact that I was working my job at Walmart as a cashier.
Okay.
And I was 139 pounds at the time. I still wasn't eating and all
pretty
that stuff.
Slim.
And
okay.
A guy came up and dropped 3 apples on my till, and I punched in the numbers, and he told me it was the wrong price. So I pulled up the flyer and showed him it was the right price. He then came back with a hard plastic sign that you slip the numbers into and frisbee a square into my nose, which cut my nose. And I quit my job that day. And went home and realized I didn't want to work a job where I hated what I was doing, or where I was staring at the clock all day and just wishing I was anywhere else. But and I also didn't want to work a job where I was being degraded as a human being so some guy could save 50 cents on 3 apples. And
right, okay.
So I went home and started looking for a new job. And once I came to that conclusion, I was just like, I created my own system to figure out what it was I wanted to do with my life. And my project, my ride across Canada, my film and everything was the culmination of those results. So I had actually started planning all this before I was even off methadone. So it was, I understood that like it just gave me something bigger to go after that basically hurled me past that final little bit of getting off of it.
But generally it was sort of from within. It was like a self-direction.
Yeah, I didn't go to any counseling or anything, but in retrospect I probably should have. Didn't go. Just kind of figured it out, thankfully. And But like what worked for me won't necessarily work for the next person. There is no one-size-fits-all solution to addiction or specifically opioid dependency. It's something you got to work at for sure. But you also have to know, like I said, with OrbeOK.ca, you have to know what it's doing to your body so you actually have an understanding of what's going on within you. I only understood as much as I felt, like physically, with withdrawal and everything like that. So it's a very complex problem to navigate. But again, I think education is the key to it all.
Okay. This might be a hard question to answer, but is there something that distinguishes opioid addiction from other addictions, like, say, gambling addiction or, I don't know, shopaholic, workaholic?
Well, I think opioid dependency, you have the physical effects of it where you're physically ill if you don't have it. Like, if you don't have it, you're sweating, you're sweating, you have hot flashes, cold sweats, runny nose, diarrhea.
People just don't really get that.
Yeah, that's, I think, what the big defining thing of it is with that. But it's a very tricky. That's also part of why it's so difficult to get off of it and beat that.
It seems to be so. In pharmacy school, we're taught a little bit about addiction, but not a lot. But it does seem to be that opioid addiction, there's potential for addiction in anything. But something about opioid addiction really gets right to, like, the core center, like, in deep, deeper than other things. I know that opioids act on, like, your endogenous pain system.
Yeah, your dopamine system's all messed up.
Really kind of right at the heart of what you are.
Yeah, like it changes you. It changes your whole entire, it changes everything about you. And in terms of like a pharma, like I had to go to a pharmacy every day at one point to get my drink. And I think it's very, in terms of pharmacists, I think they should be very conscious of when they're filling prescriptions and kind of read the body language and know what to look for. And if someone's always constantly coming in to pick up their prescription early, or there's little things like that you can look for to kind of as an indicator.
Right. Okay. I really want to talk about your experience with pharmacists. Did you have, like, you're on methadone for 5 years?
Yeah.
So did you have, like, a good relationship with your pharmacist at that time, or were they helpful, or?
Yeah, they were nice people. I mean, I didn't really, like, I've seen people freak out on the pharmacist because they wouldn't fill up their methadone script early or wouldn't fill up their pain meds early. But I think that, I don't know, they're very responsible people. So it was, but I never really abused it. So, like, per se, where I abused methadone probably for the first like year or so I was on it, where I got my carries, because after you go and do clean samples, you can double dose. And then I was just as high as I was off of Oxy. So it definitely has holes in the program, but I don't. But it's better to have it than not have it in terms of, that was the difference between me thinking about going on knocking off a pharmacy versus going to work.
Right.
So you have to have that some kind of stability there too, and that's what that provided me with.
Okay, so all right, that seems to be pretty consistent with, when I started a pharmacy school, I was a little bit against methadone because it seemed like you're just substituting one opioid for another, and it's really hard to get off methadone. A lot of people are on for the rest of their life. It doesn't seem like really a solution. But then I talked to some people who basically said to me that if it weren't for methadone, they would be dead.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can see the argument of substituting one thing for the other. I personally am a bigger believer in Suboxone than I am methadone because it has naloxone in it. So
yeah.
It has a less potential for any kind of misuse. But that's my own. Even though I'm like a product of the methadone system, I've seen a quicker turnover rate with the use of Suboxone, like in terms of people getting their life together.
Okay. let's talk a little bit about that now. It's Monday morning, and I have not really brushed up on this, but Suboxone is a partial, it's a mix of two drugs, one of which is, correct me if I'm wrong here, one of which is buprenorphine, which is a partial, one of the drugs is a partial opioid agonist, and one of them is a partial antagonist.
Yep.
So you can't really get the high dose thing because it'll start antagonizing. We've been over this on the show before.
How oh, really?
Activate your receptors and antagonists kind of block the receptors.
Right.
And so you're a fan of this?
I'm a bigger supporter of it.
Makes sense.
Because methadone, there's just too many holes in the program. It just doesn't, I mean, and I only know it because I abuse those holes. And but like I said, it's just my observations. I'm not a expert on it or anything like that, but just in my observations of people I personally know who've been on Suboxone have had a fairly quicker turnover rate than methadone. So
okay, I asked you about if you had had any good experiences with a pharmacist, and you said that they were nice people, and I get that response so many times, and I really don't like it. I think pharmacists oftentimes fail to do their job and make up for it by just being nice.
I've certainly had bad experiences with pharmacists. In fact, the same pharmacists I thought like that I was talking about are nice. They're generally nice people, but they have their days like anyone else. But
yeah.
It's But I definitely think with responsibility in terms of when you're, I mean, I think it starts with the physician who's prescribing opiates, but I also think it's both the responsibility of the physician and the pharmacist to, because the pharmacist sees what the doctor doesn't necessarily see, whether they're coming in to fill their stuff up early or sometimes they have to go through the physician to get the refill early.
Right.
So I think it's just responsibility of I think it's partially responsibility of a pharmacist to really, really keep an eye on when filling prescriptions for opiates to.
Okay, so that's what I wanted to ask you is, what can a pharmacist do? If I'm a fourth year pharmacy student, I'm going to graduate, and within a year I'll be out there. Like, what can I do?
It's just more of a being aware of what to look for with people who are coming in. I mean, like I was saying before, about filling scripts early, or because there's also people out there who doctor shop, and meaning they go to two separate doctors, get two prescriptions,
yeah,
and then go to different, or even sometimes the same pharma, or like, or if they see this, like, say another physician, they came in with one script from one physician, and then they come back with another from another prescription from another physician for the same thing. That's like a red flag. And there's little things like that you can look for, but also like if you see them withdrawing, like they're very irritable and you might be sweating, or just there's just the symptoms of it. And if you're like unfamiliar what those symptoms are, OrBeOK.ca has all that listed on there.
So if I see that, I see a person, and usually I try not to be overly suspicious of people. I try to be like empathetic, but then I start seeing red flags. And I start to think and get a little suspicious. What should I do?
Well, if they suspect something or are suspicious of the behavior or the timeline of the prescriptions, they could always contact the prescribing physician and see if they've looked for the same kind of suspicious activity that you're observing. And yeah, if you collaborate with them, you're more likely to get to a conclusive answer than not.
Yeah, that brings to mind, lately I've been thinking about one of the issues we have is, I mean, if a certain pharmacist has a good relationship with a certain doctor, then they'll be easy to contact and easy to share information. But generally, each sort of doctor or clinic has their own records and their own hours. And it's not like every doctor is connected to every pharmacist. I think it's something they're kind of working on, both physicians and the pharmacists. But it's sort of, you know, there's privacy issues, but that's kind of...
Yeah, but I mean, I think the communication between the two is a lot more important than not doing it. I mean, what could come out of not making that phone call to speak with that doctor could kill somebody.
Yeah.
So that, it's pivotal that that communication is there. And even if you did your best to try to contact them, that's doing your job to the T.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. This is a bit of changing gears, but I read a quote from Stephen Harper. He said he was talking about, I think he was opposed to what they were doing in the downtown East Side by sort of having safe injection sites and things like that. And he said something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing here, but it was, let's not make a social problem out of a criminal one.
That is ridiculous.
Okay.
That's totally absurd. And, I mean, locking people up because of a mental health problem or pertaining with addiction, you should be focusing on the solution of getting them help and turning them into a productive member of society, not locking them up and throwing them away like a piece of trash.
Right.
And I think that's completely absurd to think that way when these people are human beings. They're not just trash to be thrown away. And I think safe injection sites, if that's preventing spreading of disease and everything of that nature, and like even if they did over to like, wait, what? There's somebody there, you know what I mean? To say that, like, throwing them in jail is not solving anything.
Right. I definitely agree. I mean, it doesn't seem like a criminal problem. It seems like the definition of a social problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%.
So, okay. And the solution then is?
Yeah, the solution is definitely not to throw people away in jail because of that. I think it's to get them help. And it's also to educate the people using on what they're using and what it's doing to your body and what the dependency is doing. And like the website, Or Be Okay, again, is a very great tool to have that information. And it's just I think education is the key to it all, but some people are more receptive to it than others. And it's, but yeah, I can tell you what the answer isn't, is locking people up for it.
Okay. I work in a pharmacy down in the downtown East Side.
Yeah, and I filmed down there for my
documentary.
Oh,
really? Okay. Yeah. So if we see a lot of people, you know, dealing with addiction, and it seems to be hand in hand with like mental health.
Yes, well, it's under the umbrella of mental health. So.
And when you talk to these people, it sort of reminds me of your story. It's story after story of this trauma, usually when they were young. It's usually extremely painful or extreme loneliness.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if society can kind of, like you said, I think education is a good place to start. But in the end, maybe society can move forward and kind of at least decrease these instances of childhood trauma. Maybe we can fight the addiction from that side?
I think mental health is a massive issue that we need to be addressed more. And in the last X amount of years, it has made leaps and bounds. But I think if we did the same thing for addiction, and then we could start actually taking a... We can take an analysis of how we've done things and make that better, make a better system out of the way we've approached it, or like taking a look at how we did it in the past versus how we should move forward.
Right. Do you think they'll ever invent a drug that can cure addiction?
Ooh. I have no idea, to be perfectly honest.
Okay. I personally think that like you said, we have made leaps and bounds, and this goes for addiction and mental health. There are some medications that really help people. But as far as, you know, solving the problem, it's really, I don't know. I feel like you got to get back to that source.
Curb it before it gets worse. I mean, like I said, I was not educated by any stretch of the imagination on what was going on within my body and what, other than what I was feeling, and nor what was available to me in order to get help. And if you understand and are educated enough, that's why I always say it all starts with the education. If you know what it's doing to your body, you know what your resources are, it gives you the tools in order to move forward. And, you know, orbeokay.ca is a great place to begin with that process. But it's very difficult to get past. But like I said, if you're educated on it, you can kind of nail it before it gets to become a worse problem.
Right. Early detection. Okay. I have a curious question, and it might be hard to answer to, but I get that you've you've struggled with opioid addiction, and now you've cut that out, so you're clean.
Yep.
But they're really, like, effective for pain. So if you were dislocated your shoulder or something really painful, what would you
see, that I'm not against the existence of opiates or
okay.
I'm against the prescribing of them when they're not necessary. I mean, like, you have OxyContin that was designed for a terminally ill cancer patient, for example. And then when you start pushing out those very powerful ones for a broken finger or a sore elbow, which I've seen and documented in my film, it's
really?
It's ridiculous. Okay. And so I definitely think that there are, like, obviously like something like a Percocet or is a lot less stronger than an OxyContin.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I mean, within moderate, like, and but if the person can repeatedly coming back saying that they're still having the same problem or having, like, then that's another sign that you're just like, okay, there's, you should be healed up by now. And, like, it should, like, obviously there might be some residual pain there, but it's, I mean, prescribing responsibly, I think, is what
okay.
should be done in a lot better.
But they definitely have their place.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Like, if I was laying on my deathbed or something like that, yeah, I'd want the strong stuff too. If I had, like, cancer and I was just in agony, and I'd want to die with some kind of dignity, or like, and that I think that's perfectly acceptable when you're having, like, crazy high, like high.
Right, it's just taking it for fun. Okay.
Yeah, but like when yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, what I really want to ask is, like, if you were in the hospital, like, this bad injury, and they gave you opioids, would you, like, revert back to dependence?
Ironically, when I got back from my bike ride, I was in a car accident. I got T-boned when I was in a cab.
Oh.
And the doctor had asked me if I wanted anything for the pain. I just started laughing because of the irony of it all. I'm like, no, I'll just grab some Advil and I should be good.
Really?
Like, I just won't. I'm not willing to even test the waters with it. It's just not something I'm willing to ever do.
Right
ever,
on,
ever
right
again.
On.
So it's a... I understand, like, how what that did to me the first time around, and I'm like, yeah, I'm not even willing to delve in or even flirt with that idea. So now it's just not my thing. I'm like, unless I was just, like, on my like laid
right,
up
yeah,
there, broke
okay.
every bone in my body, then like that would be a little bit more of a different circumstance.
Yeah, at the end game.
Yeah.
Okay, wow, yeah, but I you agree that it's there's really nobody else who can make that choice other than the individual.
Yeah, I think it's a thing on the individual and the pharmacist, or the
just to
not
take
the pharmacist,
the pain.
Like in the physician prescribing. I mean, typically, if you tell any doctor you've dealt with addiction before, they're less likely to prescribe you anything that might even send you down that hole.
Right.
Which is good, but
yeah.
It's a very hard problem to navigate.
Yeah.
Like,
wow.
It's like it's so complex that it's just. It's really hard to figure out what the right way to go about everything is. So,
okay. I want to kind of finish by kind of saying an opinion that I have, and I want to see what you think of it. So I want to start by reviewing that some of the drugs we've mentioned, including OxyContin and Percocet. Like I said, I haven't really done my research. I know OxyContin is pretty famous. The drug is oxycodone.
Yes.
And they put it in, like, a kind of high potency. It's Contin because it's continuous release. So it's designed to kind of last all day.
Yeah, but the thing with that is, it, like, when I was using it, you just scrape that time release off, and you just get it right away.
Right.
And
okay.
Even at that, I was snorting it at the time, so it was just within 20 minutes, I was a lot.
Instant.
Like, I was gone.
Okay. And after that, in response to that, like, the huge abuse of OxyContin, they made something called OxyNeo.
Yes, that's when it gels, when it hits.
Right, it's supposed to be impossible to bust up and.
Yeah, that was.
Does that solve the problem?
When that came out, that was very. I thought it would have been a good idea if they would have did that from the beginning, because a lot of people, like, I know personally know people, once they took OxyContin off and went to OxyNeo, went to heroin.
Really?
So it. Yeah.
Not really a solution there. Okay.
Yeah. I don't really know what the answer is to that. But
no problem,
just,
no problem.
It's, yeah, it is what it is.
That's okay. The one problem with OxyNeo is very expensive, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
So another drug we mentioned was Percocet, and I'm not good with brand names. I think it's Do you know? Is it oxycodone with ASA? Okay. I'll have to fact check that. Yeah. I'll fact check that. Don't hold me to that. But Percocet is like another similar, I think it's oxycodone. And then you mentioned heroin, which is diacetylmorphine. Mm-hmm. And so all of these are derivatives of basically the one molecule morphine. Other drugs that have been abused, opioids, are fentanyl, very strong.
Yeah, fentanyl, yeah,
right?
Yeah, hydromorphone.
We have codeine, hydromorph. Yeah. So as a pharmacy student, I'm thinking like morphine, just straight old-fashioned morphine, was very effective, and it had abuse potential too. People were abusing it back in the day.
Yeah.
But then scientists sort of, in my mind, for no reason, decided to make all these kind of fancy opioids just for no other reason than other than they could. So now we have heroin, now we have codeine, methadone, fentanyl, sufentanyl, really, really strong stuff. And I'm wondering, like, if we need it at all, if we could have just stuck with good old-fashioned morphine.
Well, that's the thing with opiates is that there's over 400,000 Canadians affected by it now, by opioid dependency. And when you factor in family and friends, the number's in the millions of people who are directly affected by it. And yeah, you have to ask the objective question: is what's going? Like, is this necessary? Like, and how far is this level going to go up before we actually tackle it? And like, I mean, there was Zohydro ER that was, I'm not sure where that stands right now in terms of coming up, but that one was supposed to be, what, like, somewhere in the ballpark of fentanyl in terms of strength. And it's just like, is this necessary at this point in time? Like, it's just...
That's exactly how I feel, yeah.
It's rather ridiculous sometimes when I try to wrap my head around it, but...
All right. Well... I think that's some good knowledge for our listeners. Is there anything else you'd like to add at the end?
Yeah, I'm doing the bike ride across Canada again next summer.
Okay.
My film will be out in May. And
how can we watch your film? Is it in theaters?
Well, I'm doing film festivals right now, so it's... I don't know where right now to watch it, but it'll be available in distribution or for distribution in May.
Okay,
so,
and what's the title?
It's called Inspire.
Okay.
And my website is inspiredbyexample.ca if you like to follow me and my... crazy adventure I'm on. And,
all right.
And if more importantly, if you have any kind of problem with opiate or suspect a loved one has a problem or you think you have a problem with opiates or you're looking for more information pertaining to it, go to orbeok.ca.
orbeok.ca.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot for being with us this week, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Are you hosting an event on campus? We are UBC's Emergency Medical Aid Team, a UBC peer programs, and we provide free first aid coverage for events organized through UBC clubs and organizations. We cover events such as Storm the Wall, Day of the Longboat, and Residence Life events. We also offer tailored workshops about a variety of first aid and safety topics to the UBC community. If you would like to request coverage for any of your events, find us at students.ubc.ca. If you would like to request workshops, please email us at emat.coordinator@ubc.ca to get in contact with our team.
All right, all right, and we're back. Welcome, radio fans. You're listening to Transition State on CITR 101.9. I'm your host, Adam, as per always. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Chris Kull. That was very informative for a person like me who thinks nonstop about pharmaceutical issues in the community. I just wanted to mention that I did fact check that Percocet is not oxycodone with acetylsalicylic acid. Percocet is oxycodone with acetaminophen. Okay, everything else in that I think checked out. Buprenorphine is a partial opioid agonist, and naloxone is a full opioid antagonist. Put them together and you have Suboxone. And I'd also like to take this moment to mention that anytime we mention specific medications, it is in no way an endorsement of those medications. We're just trying to get some awareness out there. I think it's a bit of a crime that nobody knows anything about the drugs that they're taking. Okay? So that was good, and we spat some knowledge at the airwaves, and now we're going to hear some more music. We're going to start with a singer that I'm very excited about, Wendy Atkinson. The album is The Last Fret, and the song is Vancouver Winter. So that's pretty apropos. Let me know what you think. And that was it. Pretty cool, hey? Okay, that was, again, that was Wendy Atkinson with A Bucket and Some Water laying on the artistic vibes for us. We're going to hear another couple tracks from Wendy Atkinson. We're now going to hear Ukulele Shock and then New 2. So stay tuned to Transition State on CITR 101.9 FM.
Sister, I left my dad. It was the late 60s, and that just wasn't done, especially by a woman. We moved to Toronto, and my mom rented the upstairs of an old house. I remember having a radio. Maybe we did. I don't remember listening to it. Sing songs in the car. Her little red VW bug. My sister and I would sing along at the top of our lungs. The 60s. But my favorite was Blowin' in the Wind. It wasn't until many years later that I heard Bob Dylan's version on the radio. Shocked. Because I thought my mom wrote it.
And we are back. Welcome back, radio fans. You're listening to Transition State on CITR 101.9. That was Victoria band Psychosomatic Itch with their awesome track Cold Call. And of course, people who've been listening all show will know that before that we heard some artistic musings of Wendy Atkinson. So that just about wraps it up for this week, radio fans. I hope you stay tuned for Dunkin' Donuts Tasty Treats coming up next. He's always got some good beats. And I hope you'll tune in next week. We have a few awesome shows lined up, including interviews with Mr. John Shasky, Dr. Peter Lowen, and other, the infamous and sardonically irreverent Mr. Saul Williams. So stay tuned for that in the upcoming weeks, radio fans. I'm going to leave you with one more track. This is from another Victoria band. I heard about them on this compilation album called 15 for 15, Victoria Oddities 2015. There are actually 16 tracks because one of them is a secret track. So, okay, I'll let them get away with that for artistic license. But anyway, the band is Tango Lima. And the track is called The Realization or The Exact Moment You Fell in Love. Doesn't that sound like something you want to listen to? Okay, so until next week, radio fans, stay cool out there and stay pharmaceutically aware. Peace. Technical difficulties. Thank you.